If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It was just 1 year ago that the world changed, seemingly overnight. COVID-19 went from being a growing threat in other places to a reality here in Iowa. I've been thinking a lot about that time. I remember how worried, how scared I was. I was afraid that it would take us 3 or 4 months to crush the curve. I remember hearing that maybe 700 Iowans could die of COVID-19, and I was horrified by that. And now I just can't believe how naive I was, how naive most of us were. This pandemic has been worse than almost anyone imagined it could have been in those early days and months. And now, a year later, more than 340,000 Iowans have gotten the virus. More than 5,574 Iowans have died. Iowa has one of the highest per capita infection rates in the nation, with more than 1 in 10 Iowans having contracted the virus. The 3 approved COVID-19 vaccines are bringing much-needed relief and hope, but Iowans are still getting sick, and the impact of this virus will be felt for a very long time. This hour, we're going to reflect on our pandemic year with COVID-19 survivors, 3 of the first COVID-19 survivors we interviewed here on Iowa Public Radio, all infected early on in the pandemic. I'll also talk with epidemiologist Eli Perencevich and Des Moines Register columnist Courtney Crowder. My first guest today is Nora Berner, a long-haul COVID patient, mother of 4 from Iowa City, who works for an Episcopal church and is a seminary student. She first contracted COVID-19 last April, right after Easter. We spoke in August about her long-haul symptoms then, but 11 months later, she is still struggling. Nora, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And just briefly, let's talk about what happened. It was just after Easter Sunday that you got sick. And that was really early in the pandemic. There were really no treatments at that point, right?
No, nothing.
So as time went on, you expected to start feeling better. You were never hospitalized during that early time, were you?
No, not during the early time.
And as time went on, how did you feel? What was going on, let's say, through the summer months with your body?
I think through the summer months, especially towards like August or even into September, I started to feel like I had a little bit more energy, but I was having significant lung issues and tachycardia. So it was pretty obvious that my vascular system was still, you know, figuring things out. And I think you may remember from the previous interview that the summer was really challenging for me to get care. Long haulers were a very new thing at that time.
Yeah.
It was sort of like if you weren't hospitalized or well in 2 weeks, people didn't know what to do with you. So it was hard for me and for doctors to know what to do.
Many other members of your family also had COVID-19 after you were infected. Did everybody else in the family recover as they were expected to do?
Yes. And we, because of the testing limits early on, we never had a positive diagnosis. So we have a clinical diagnosis. I was the only one who fell ill. We had 2 of our kids have some of COVID toes. So they were the only people who had exhibited any symptoms. But everybody's just fine now.
So during the summer, it was hard for you to get care. Doctors didn't know what to do for you. And of course, we remember in the summertime, the cases were lower than they are now. But still, the cases were building. Hospitals were busy. Mm-hmm. When did you start, if you feel like you've been getting the right care, when did you feel like people started being able to treat you and take you seriously?
Yeah, I would say that it is still an ongoing process. It's my case is particularly challenging because that one test that I qualified for in April was done incorrectly. So I didn't have that positive COVID test. So I don't qualify for the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics post-COVID clinic, which is a real challenge. But how I was able to start being heard, I guess, and listened to was I had a friend who was acquainted with an infectious disease doc and told her my story, and I was able to get into infectious disease at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And that doctor, Dr. Herwalt, has just been amazing. She has facilitated me seeing tons of specialists. She's very responsive and wonderful, and is not afraid to say, I don't know, right? I don't know what's going on, but let's try this. And she's amazing. I'm really grateful for her.
Nora, I just want to revisit what you just said. So you never got an official positive test, but you had COVID-19. You did get a positive clinical diagnosis, but you can't be part of that clinic because you never got that clinical test that said you were positive?
Yep, that's a requirement for admission to the clinic. I have lots of big feelings about that.
I'm sure you do, but also I'm sure that many others do as well, because we know that those tests have not been perfect and they were hard to get in those early months. So let's talk about what you've learned about what COVID has done to your body. What, before you got COVID, you were a very healthy 40-year-old woman, mother of four, very active, athletic. What do you know about what has changed?
So we're making a lot of sort of best guesses and eliminating, you know, some diagnoses at this point. But I have, my lungs are affected for sure. That's been an ongoing issue for me. But over the winter here, I've developed significant heart issues from COVID. I was even hospitalized for 4 days in the intermediate intensive care unit and the cardiac unit at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And so their best guess is that COVID has damaged the microvessels in my heart. So my heart isn't getting enough oxygen because those microvessels constrict instead of dilate. And so I'm working with the cardiology team to try to retrain those vessels to open up. But that's been a real blow to me, you know, feeling like I was getting better and then to have pretty significant cardiac issues 9+ months later it was really hard.
Yeah. Is the prognosis good for the heart disease that you're dealing with?
Yes. I mean, so everything is a guess at this point, right? Because I'm one of those first long haulers. Those of us who got sick in March and April are still kind of cutting edge as far as what this looks like 9 to 12 months later. And I guess now we're much closer to 12 months later. They're hopeful that we can retrain those vessels in my heart to open up. But it's a really delicate balance because, you know, me trying to do cardio rehab, I did just a few short walks and that triggered a relapse for me with fever and lots of other issues that I'd been having in the summer and the fall. So it's a really strange balance to sort of want to stretch the body and then not be able to. But the prognosis, I'm really hopeful about it. I'm really holding mentally that I will be met well and I will be whole again. I'm not going to accept anything less than that.
You had a relapse that felt like you had just gotten COVID?
Close to it, yeah. It wasn't quite as bad as when I was first sick, but, you know, fevers, body aches, quite a bit of congestion and pain. And my infectious disease doc guessed that it was due to kind of these inflammation resurgences that they're seeing in some long haulers. So there was sort of like an inflammation explosion in my body because I had stressed it a little bit too far in trying to work out.
During all of this time, not only are you dealing with these health problems, but you're living the same pandemic reality of every other parent in the United States. You've got four kids. How has that been going? How has school been going?
You know, I always say this, like, I have the most amazing family and children and husband. They are so resilient. I'm really impressed at how well they have taken on these challenges and still been able to really name grief and hardship. The three oldest kids, the junior high and high school students, are in a small learning pod with four other students. And that's been a really beautiful gift to us, so that they're able to see some other kids, but we're still able to stay safe, and protect me from getting reinfected. And then our four-year-old's preschool masks 100% of the time and has amazing COVID safety protocols. So he's been able to go to school. And that's been a real gift for us.
How have you been able to deal with the emotional burden of all of this, the grief over the loss of your health, but at the same time experiencing the pandemic, seeing so much loss and so much pain?
It's, as it is for all of us, it is almost incomprehensible to me to think about the gravity and the level of loss, not just in my life, but really in Iowa and across the world. I've allowed myself to grieve and lament and to pray about these things. I haven't fallen into sort of, you know, the toxic positivity. So at the same time that I grieve and lament, I still hold on to hope. I don't let the grief and lament take over. And my faith really helps me in that. But how I've dealt with it is just getting good support. And I have, you know, I talk to a therapist. I journal. I've started doing art. I try to get outside and see the sunshine and just some of those very basic things that help me feel human and alive and help the weight of all this not feel so heavy.
Nora, I want you to stay with me for just a couple more minutes. This hour, we're reflecting on our pandemic year. I'm talking with three COVID-19 survivors. A little bit later in the hour, I'll talk with Dr. Eli Perencevich and later on, Des Moines Register columnist Courtney Crowder. Nora Berner is with me right now. She is a long-haul COVID patient who lives in Iowa City. She first contracted COVID-19 last April, right after Easter, and 11 months later, she's still struggling. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are reflecting on 1 year of the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 5,601 Iowans have died of COVID-19 in the past year. And of course, Iowans are still getting sick. 800 new cases reported just today. Iowa has one of the highest per capita infection rates in the nation, with more than 1 in 10 Iowans already having contracted the virus. There is so much hope on the horizon. And in this hour, we are just looking back over the year. I'm talking with three COVID-19 survivors. Coming up in a little while, I'll talk with epidemiologist Dr. Eli Perencevich, and later on, Des Moines Register columnist Courtney Crowder. And with me right now is Nora Berner, who got sick last April. She's still dealing with serious health effects of having COVID-19. She's what's called a long-haul COVID patient. And Nora, before I let you go, there is so much hope on the horizon right now. Of course, Iowans are getting vaccinated. Millions of Americans have already gotten vaccinated. And we can really see the light at the end of this tunnel. How are you feeling about this moment?
It feels good, right? It was a beautiful day yesterday. It was 70 degrees. My dear grandmother, who I love, has been vaccinated. So many people who we care about have been vaccinated. And every time someone I hear about that I know is vaccinated, I get emotional because it is one less person who will get sick. I'm really, really hopeful. This feels like something new will come and we will be able to move through this, but we're not quite there yet. So it's important for me to let people know that it's important to still wear your mask, and that wearing a mask in public is an act of love, justice, and compassion. In wearing that mask, you may very well prevent someone else from turning out like me. So it's important to still wear your mask and yet still be really excited and hopeful about those wonderful vaccines that are coming and that are here.
Do your health conditions that you've developed from COVID-19, does that qualify you to get a vaccine?
They don't. I was told by my cardiologist that my specific heart disease is not heart disease that is not the right diagnosis for the state of Iowa for me to qualify for this group right now of those with pre-existing conditions. So
that's hard. That's
another challenge, but I know I'll get the vaccine someday. I'll get it as soon as I possibly can.
Well, Nora, I hope that you continue to improve and that you regain your health. But thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It really, I'm certain, has helped many others.
Thank you, Charity. And thank you for agreeing to talk with me last year. It's been great to walk this year with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Nora Berner, who lives in Iowa City. She's a mother of four. She works for an Episcopal church and is a seminary student and a long haul COVID patient. And my next guest is also one of the first people that I talked to about COVID-19, about surviving it. He was one of the first people that his doctors treated with COVID-19. Val Swinton is a pastor at Clarksville Church of Christ. He was hospitalized last March and very nearly died. It has been a long road to recovery. Val, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Charity. I appreciate you calling me. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming back again. And we've talked a couple of times. The first time you were hospitalized, it really didn't look like you were ever going to leave the hospital, but you did. And then when you got home, things didn't exactly go smoothly. Remind us a little bit of what you've gone through.
Well, on March 29th, the doctor called my wife in the intensive care unit at Mercy One in Waterloo and said that her husband was dying. They didn't think I'd last through the day. And she needed to prepare herself for that. She was suffering from a mild case of COVID, so she couldn't even come and see me in what they thought would be my final hours. And so the nurse in the intensive care unit called my son in Des Moines and told him he would have to come up and claim the body after I died because my wife wasn't able to do it. So that's where they were on March 29th. And my son did something that I'm convinced saved my life. He went on Facebook and said, pray for my dad. And it went viral. We had people in Taiwan and Brazil saying they were praying for me. And I obviously, I didn't die. No. I came back. And I was in the hospital about 3 weeks. In 2 weeks of that, I was in a coma. And they finally let me go home. I was the first person to be treated for COVID at Mercy One. And they told me that a lot of times they weren't sure if the treatment would even be effective because they'd never treated anybody before. And I got to give a shout out to Mercy One. The medical staff there in Waterloo was incredible. I mean, considering I was the first one they ever treated, they did an excellent job. So I went home after 3 weeks, and 2 weeks later I got pneumonia and I passed out and broke my ankle. So I had to go back to the hospital to be treated for pneumonia and to be fitted for a boot to heal my ankle. And about 3 weeks after I was released from the hospital, I fainted again. And the doctors realized that I had a buildup of some fibrous material in my left lung, again related to COVID. And so I had to undergo a 2.5-hour operation to remove that fibrous material from my lung. They had to take out a rib in order to get to my lung. And so that was a tough summer.
Yeah.
I spent most of last summer in bed. I didn't need to socially isolate. No one had to force me to. I didn't have a choice.
Yeah. How are you feeling now?
Well, gosh, I'm almost 100% back. I'm back. I love to work out. I'm back in the gym. I'm almost full-time as a minister again. And we're traveling to Des Moines to visit my son and his family. I'm almost back to totally normal.
Oh, that's such good news. And how is your wife? She also had COVID. You said a much more mild case than yours, although it doesn't take much to have a more mild case than what you went through. Is she okay?
True. She's doing fine. She and I both had our first COVID vaccination shot yesterday.
Oh, that's great.
And So in 1 month, we'll get the second one. And so things are looking up.
Oh, that's exciting. And I know that there are a lot of people in Iowa who are hesitant to get that vaccine. You weren't exactly excited about getting the vaccine,
no.
But you did it.
I confess, I was totally ambivalent about it. I wasn't against it, but I really didn't want to go to all the effort to get it. As bad as I had COVID, I thought, well, maybe I've still got immunity. I don't know.
Interesting.
But our pharmacy called us. We didn't sign up for it. They called us and said, we got a shot for you. If you want to come in, we'll give it to you. And I thought, well, why not? I mean, we're not paying for it. And they've got one for us. So we went in yesterday and we got our first one.
Well, thank you for getting vaccinated. It's... In your case, it may not even be as important about protecting you, but it will keep others from having to go through what you went through. I mean, people are still getting that sick. We just had the report of 27 more dead Iowans today.
Yeah, I know. That's rough. I hope people do get their shots. I'm surprised at the number of people up here who have said they're not going to get a shot. They don't trust the fact that this vaccine was developed so quickly. And despite the fact that they know that that I almost died from it, they just don't trust the vaccine. So probably more than half the people that I've talked to say they're not going to get it.
Oh, wow. That really makes me worry to hear that. I hope that your experience will help them understand how important it is. And here we are, before I let you go, we are at a moment where we can see the end of this pandemic. At least we hope we can, if enough people decide to get vaccinated. How are you feeling right now?
Right now, I feel 100%. I got up this morning. I was listening to Nora before myself, and she said she went for a walk. The sun was shining up here this morning, so I just went out and walked for 20 minutes. You know, last summer, that would have just devastated me for a week, but I feel good that I can do that now.
Oh, well, I'm so glad that you're doing so much better. And thank you for sharing your journey with us, for talking with us so many times over the past year. I hope your health just continues to improve and you stay well. Thank you so much.
I will, Charity, and thank you so much for calling. Call anytime.
All right. Val Swinton is a pastor at Clarksville Church of Christ. He was hospitalized with COVID-19 last March and very nearly died. It has been a long road to recovery, but here he is now feeling so much better. And my next guest is Siobhan Spain of Des Moines. She's the director of Mainframe Studios. And I first spoke to her last May. That was during a time when people were getting COVID, but the numbers were pretty low, around 200 cases a day. Most people did not yet know someone who had the virus here in Iowa, and a lot of people who did have COVID-19 didn't feel comfortable sharing their experience. Siobhan chose to be very open about what her family had gone through. She is on the line with us again now. Hello, Siobhan.
Hi, Charity. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for coming back. And remind us again, you were one of the first people that in your circle to get COVID-19. It was way back in March, right?
Yes. My husband got diagnosed on March 19th, which happens to be my birthday. And it was pretty intense moment because there was so many things unknown. And I just remember just so many questions. I mean, my mind was just swimming with what our life was going to be like to help him and alter the way, you know, our lives just changed in an instant. And then I was diagnosed less than a week later.
And you have a child. She was not tested. Back at that point, we really weren't testing kids at all.
Right. They did not want to waste a test because the tests were very rare or in low supply as well. So they were just assuming that she had it, but they didn't want to, again, waste a test on her, is what they, how they kind of posed it to me.
Yeah. So during that time, all three of you probably went through COVID-19. When we spoke back in May, you were feeling better. Do you feel like there have been long-term symptoms that you or your husband have dealt with?
My husband definitely had loss of smell and taste, and I don't know if it's fully back yet, but it's enough that it's not an issue anymore, which we're really grateful for. I know friends and family members that have long haul effects, and it's very real and very scary.
What has your year been like? Again, of course, dealing with all of the same difficulties that all the rest of us have been dealing with as a parent and as a working individual. How have things gone for you and your family?
You know, I just think of all the stories that everybody has to tell about this past year. I mean, Nora's and Val's is just really incredible. And I think every one of us probably has really incredible stories that we've gone through, and ours is no different. We've had a surprisingly number of tragedies in my family and in the last year, and it's been really isolating. You know, it's been troubling to deal with all the decision making that you have to do. You get decision fatigue, and then you also have to deal with family situations that prevent you from being together and grieving together. And it's really intense. It's hard to even talk about.
You lost your mom during this time, didn't you?
Yes, that is one of them. Definitely. I lost my mom, and she broke her hip and decided it was time to call it quits. And it was a really amazingly hard and amazingly magical process, but COVID definitely wreaked havoc in the process, and I was one of the few that was in a position to go be by her bedside at the hospital and make decisions and be her advocate to go to hospice, and you know, it was, everybody wanted to see her and talk to her and have access to her, and it was a lot of organizing and processing and decision making and just trying to get through it one step at a time. You know, one thing that definitely this last year has made me realize is just be so grateful. I think I'm a pretty grateful person already, but it's just amazing. Just the simplest things, just the gratitude level has just gone up a hundredfold.
It's been a year since you and your husband have had COVID. And of course, we don't know everything about how long immunity might last, but the people pretty much agree that it doesn't last more than a year. Do you feel nervous that this could happen to you again?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've never taken it for granted that we had any more freedom than anybody else. We wear masks all the time. We social distance. We are very careful. Our daughter's in a learning pod as well, and we want to keep that pod bubble very safe. We care about the people that she has taken her under their wings, and we're grateful that she has a social, you know, sphere that she's able to function in during this time, because it's so important to have that personal human interaction to get us through. So we've been wearing masks, and I've been tested a couple times this last year when I just got, it's easy to get paranoid.
Yeah, I'm sure.
When you've had it and you just know how scary it is.
Yeah, it's easy to get paranoid when you haven't had it. I'll let you in on that
true.
As
Very
well.
True. Very true.
So we just have about a minute left here, Siobhan. Yeah. But again, the vaccines are bringing so many people hope. You don't yet qualify for a vaccine, but
no.
This is something you think about a lot, isn't it?
Oh, just like Nora said, I just get giddy when I hear people get vaccinated. I just want to do a little happy dance around the block just to like, I'm just really glad that they are safeguarding their health and their future and their family. You know, it's really great. So there is hope on the way, but it's really hard to get too optimistic with the numbers the way they are. And it's still very concerning and it's still very real.
Well, Siobhan, I really appreciate that you were willing to share your story so early and fight some of the stigma that some people were feeling about having COVID-19 at that point. Again, I'm sure that that helped a lot of people take it seriously and be open about what they were going through.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity. It's a great conversation.
Siobhan Spain of Des Moines, she's the director of Mainframe Studios and came down with COVID-19 last March. She was very open about sharing her story at that time, at a time when very few people knew people who had COVID-19. Of course, now I think we all do. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with epidemiologist Dr. Eli Perencevich of Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are reflecting on our pandemic year. It has been a year since COVID-19 came to Iowa, at least since it was officially identified here in this state. A year later, more than 340,000 Iowans have gotten the virus. We have one of the highest per capita infection rates in the nation, with more than 1 in 10 Iowans having contracted COVID-19, and more than 5,601 Iowans have died of COVID-19 in the past year. With me now is Dr. Eli Perencevich. He's an epidemiologist and a professor at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. He is one of the people that we've been turning to since the beginning of the pandemic to help us understand what was, what is going on. He's also been very vocal in trying to share life-saving advice and information with the public and vocally disagreeing with policies that he feels put people at risk. Dr. Perencevich, welcome back to the show.
Me back.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And all right, let's travel back in time. Of course, as an epidemiologist, you were reading all of the information about COVID-19, probably in a way that the rest of us weren't, although a lot of us were watching very, very closely. And so much of what we were learning was changing over time. The first big misunderstanding, I think, was about masks and the efficacy of masks. Take us back to that time and what you were going through as someone who had to deal with people saying, hey, you know, a week ago, the CDC said we shouldn't wear masks and now we're supposed to wearing masks, you know, that confusion and that anger.
Yeah. So that's a good point. It's been a long year for all of us. And I think the first word that comes to mind when thinking about this is that we just have to be humble and of course sad about what's transpired over the past year. I really enjoyed listening to Nora, Val and Siobhan share their stories and trying to center on them with all of this. But back to masks. I think, you know, we all felt you know, in healthcare anyway, and I'm a kind of trained hospital epidemiologist, so my day job is to try to prevent infection spreading in hospitals. So we're very aware around flu season and our RSV season, the benefit of masks for protecting patients. We don't want a nurse or a doctor to spread respiratory virus to their patients. And so we wear masks to protect others. And early in the pandemic, and I think one of the biggest issues was we really didn't have testings. We were really under testing early on, as you mentioned earlier, for a variety of reasons. CDC's test failed, and it created a lot of issues that were surprising. But masks were thought of protecting others in the community. And when we had very few cases in that early part where the CDC was saying, don't run out and buy masks, I think it's because we thought there were very few cases here. And so protecting others wasn't a huge part of the response, we thought. But as soon as we realized that a huge number of cases are spread from kind of asymptomatically or pre-symptomatically, which was different than the initial SARS back from 2003. As soon as we saw that happening, we realized we needed to get masks on people. And that's why they changed the recommendations, because we learn, right? It's the first time we've had one of these in 100 years. And so we're going to change recommendations going forward. We still will for the next year, because we're going to keep learning things. So as we learned and we realized it spread silently, we realized people needed to kind of sew their own cotton masks and contribute to the prevention that way.
Were you taken aback by the anger and backlash that you and so many others faced in that moment? I mean, for me, that feels like the moment that this pandemic was politicized.
Yeah, I think masks and also the earlier shutdowns were really devastating economically. And I think a lot of the backlash wasn't necessarily early on against masks, although it evolved to that. I think it was really against the shutdowns and the kind of economic kind of destruction, really, for lack of a better word, that happened as a result of those. And fortunately, we bounced back in many areas, but clearly not all the way back. So I think a lot of it was understandable from that standpoint. But masks themselves, I'm really surprised. You know, just thinking about other times our country has gone through tough times, World War II, and I wasn't alive then. But, you know, I always felt like our country was good at pulling together in times of crisis. You know, in those big things that threatened us all, we pulled together. And so I was kind of expecting masks to be kind of like the victory gardens and things like this that we all did, or at least what I was told we all did back, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. So I was really taken aback by that, but everything's been politicized. That part's been really devastating for all of us. And I think probably that's why our country suffered more than almost any other country, because we haven't had a unified response.
You have also really borne the brunt of that personally as well. Has that been hard for you?
Well, we're all going through a lot. I mean, just hearing the stories from the first half hour, we're all being affected in different ways. This is just my unique way where, you know, I've been trying to get folks to wear masks and socially distance. And throughout actually most of the summer and fall, it wasn't too bad. And I was somewhat surprised after the election. I thought things would calm down, and they didn't really, politically anyway. We did all encourage, and the governor thankfully instituted a mask mandate and some other limits in the community. And I think we all see that's had an effect. I think people change behavior, probably even without a mandate. People saw the cases rising, and it's just self-preservation. I think people started becoming more safe. So we went from 5,000 cases a day, and you know, now we're averaging maybe 500 cases a day. So there's been great improvement for that. But yeah, so because of that, certain national media outlets have kind of singled me out as someone to attack, the National Review and some other publications. And then the threatening emails and other threats come in. It's a little shocking, because, you know, I'm just trying to save lives and have people wear masks. It's not causing businesses to go out of business from wearing a mask. It's not a shutdown. So that part's been pretty surprising. And it's been hard, too, because a lot of my colleagues, actually a close friend from high school is the assistant director of health at Ohio, and she's had her house front door shot up with a gun in January because of her efforts to try to control COVID. It's just really sad how this has been politicized.
Yeah.
Across the whole country. It's not Iowa.
The majority of your work is as a researcher and an educator, but you do see patients. And there was a point when you were taking care of a COVID patient whose wife was also in the hospital with COVID. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So this is back in November, right when our cases were really spiking. And it was a little bit surprising and kind of caused me to speak up even more. I was actually off social media for 2 months leading up to the election, because I actually didn't want to politicize things. I wanted that to get through, and cases were low in the fall. And in November, admitted a patient who was in his 70s, and I started talking to him about how he thought he got COVID. And he said, well, you know, all of the restaurants and the bowling alley was open, so my wife and I thought it was safe. So we went bowling and out to dinner, I think for his birthday, and they both got COVID. He did pretty well. She really suffered. I didn't take care of her. She was at a different hospital, so they weren't even together. But I think she did pull through. But it was just kind of pointed out the importance of having good public health policy, because I think if the restaurants and bowling alleys are open, people are going to rightfully think they're safe. Not everyone is going to make the individual decision. They're going to just say, well, they just opened the restaurant, so they must be safe. I'm going to go eat out. And we know that's a really high risk activity. So at that point, I started speaking up that we needed to do something because cases were really, really exploding back there in November.
Right now, in this moment, what do you want to say to Iowans?
So I think there's kind of two major things. One, hope is definitely on the horizon. These vaccines are very effective, all three of them, close to 100% effectiveness in preventing death and hospitalization and severe disease. I know one of the previous folks, Val, mentioned that some of his friends were concerned because they were developed so rapidly. Well, I think the reason they were developed so rapidly is because we had so many patients with this pandemic that they could be tested safely for efficacy. Because for other infections, it takes years to have 50,000 patients that were exposed to an infection to get enough data. And unfortunately or fortunately, we've had a lot of cases. So these were tested on hundreds of thousands of people. They're safe vaccines and very effective. So we have a lot of hope. And I think Iowa's vaccinated 20% of folks have gotten one shot. And I think almost 10% have gotten both shots and so are fully vaccinated. And so we're really getting there. But unfortunately, over the next couple months, we're still seeing a lot of cases. 800, I think, today were reported. And so there's still a lot of disease out there, still a lot of transmission. We're not out of the woods. There's still folks that are going to develop, severe COVID and long COVID, the devastating effects we heard that Nora is still, Ms. Verner is still going through. That's kind of where we are. We're in this kind of in-between zone where we're not out of this yet. So I really hope folks still are smart and wear their masks. The data is incredibly strong around masks, despite the misinformation you hear. It's spread by droplets and aerosols out of our mouth. And so the idea that masks wouldn't keep them from others is no longer in question. They're very effective.
Well, Dr. Perencevich, thank you so much for spreading the word, and thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Dr. Eli Perencevich of University of Iowa. He's an epidemiologist and professor at Carver College of Medicine. And we have just a few minutes left, but I want to check in with Courtney Crowder. She's the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. And she, along with many other journalists around the state, has been telling the stories of those lost to COVID-19 in their project called Iowa Mourns. She and her colleagues at the Register are also doing a number of things to mark this one-year anniversary. At noon today, they'll be doing a live stream conversation with staff from Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames as they share triumphs, struggles, and lessons of the last year. They'll also be taking questions, and you can find more information about that on Facebook. And Courtney is on the line with me. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, how are you today?
I am all right. And, you know, Courtney, the last time we talked to each other was right when Iowa reached that 2,000 Iowans lost milestone. And I think back to we did a program about the loss at 1,000. We did a program about the loss at 2,000. And then the loss just ballooned. Here we are, 5,601 Iowans dead of COVID-19. And it just happened so fast. And Courtney, I know you're working so hard to share these stories and keep people's memory alive. But tell me what what you're thinking about right now.
You know, I do what I do because people, some people, not all people, some people have become numb to what this is. I think it is the foundational role of a journalist to go out, see what's happening, return to the town square and tell people of it. And as the pandemic started, I really saw a need for that town crier role, even possibly a more heightened need than when compared to most tragedies, because in most tragedies, there are images, you know, of twisted steel or bombed out concrete that we can look at and we can make sense of the number lost, 3,000. Well, look at that. That makes sense. Or even if it's as simple as the outside of a Walmart or the outside of a school, we can go there and we can mourn and we can say something happened here. But with this, this is an invisible killer. It's just wafting through our airs. And you add in the fact that so many deaths happen in nursing homes on lockdown or hospitals on lockdown, and the death just feels opaque and it feels distant. And if you haven't been affected, you don't know of it. So on a personal level, too, we aren't having funerals and the rituals that turn pain into memories or recontextualize pain, reshape it. There's no place to mourn. There's no images to show the scope. So it is people like you at IPR, people like us here at the Des Moines Register, we have to go out, we have to find who's been affected, we have to bring those stories back, and we have to tell them, because this is ruining lives, this is blowing holes through families, and, you know, it's blowing a hole through Iowa, too. And as someone who's reported on it, I feel it, and I hope people who read it and people who listen feel it as well.
Right now, in this moment, I was just talking to Dr. Perencevich about it. But, you know, we just had 800 new cases reported today. And a lot of people are acting like things are over, like the pandemic is over. We have all this hope on the one hand, but we have people getting sick and dying on the other hand. What do you want people to think about right now?
So I recently, the past 2 months, I've been reporting from inside Mary Greeley Medical Center in a different series, not Iowa Mourns, Inside COVID Siege. And I've been at the bedside as people are having conversations about end of life. I've been there for some end of life. And what sticks out to me most is the story of Tong Seng Perum, part two, whose family basically just let us in to every part of the end of her life. And she went from sitting on the COVID floor, you know, being able to move by herself, talking to her friends all day long. She loved the cell phone, talking to her friends all day long. She went from that to barely being awake in the ICU, to being on a ventilator, to passing, you know, days before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And what her family said to me was, you know, you, as average person out there, you as average Iowan, you have a chance to stop this. You do not have to play Russian roulette with other people's lives. You can put on a mask, you can socially distance, and you can save someone like their mother. That's what the science is, that's what it's saying, and so that's what I keep in my mind.
Courtney Crowder, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Charity.
Courtney Crowder of the Des Moines Register. We've been looking back on our pandemic year this hour. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. IPR News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Here First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters. Learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Here First today, wherever you get your podcasts.